My guest is Chris Mackey. He is the founder of Solutionomics, which, according to the website, is an independent, nonpartisan platform dedicated to developing and disseminating solutions for creating a more dynamic American economy. Chris Mackey has also advised the U.S. Federal Reserve. He's a contributor to the Beige Book, which is an important item in the Federal Reserve's platform. And he writes for The Hill, which is a nonpartisan publication following the workings of Congress, et cetera. Chris Mackey, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Steve. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
You know, it's hard for me to discuss anything that has to do with politics because there's so much partisan wrangling with every word that's written or every word that's spoken. And so I'd really just want to, you know, and I know that with your publication, you know, you are neutral and nonpartisan. We are the same here. So let's just try to concentrate on the facts and look at the facts only, if that's okay with you.
That would be great.
All right, let's talk about global trade. So you wrote in a recent column that the U.S. has pursued basically a free trade, I would call it maybe an open door policy, saying, you know, free trade will benefit all. So we really just want to try to promote this idea of everybody trading as free as possible. And yet we know that countries negotiate on their own behalf. As a matter of fact, the president acknowledged in a speech at the World Economic Forum saying that he expects countries to act in their own interest. So give us your thoughts about that. And then I think his strategy obviously is, in order to fix this, is the tariffs. And I'd like to hear how you think that's going.
Happy to. So something clearly needed to be done. In 2018, 13 of the 15 largest economies we traded with sold more goods to us than we did to them. So think of it this way. If we were an NFL team, that means our record would have been 2 wins, 13 losses. So something needed to be done. And part of the reason for us losing in the game of global trade is just as you mentioned. You know, we're proudly carrying the banner of free trade, and free trade, global trade can be very good for the global economy, but we need to make sure it works for the U.S. And what has happened is that while we're pursuing free trade policy, historically, other countries have not. And so that has put us at a strategic disadvantage. Now, part of the reason why we've let that happen is that trade has been used in the service of foreign policy.
Yeah.
So that's the first issue. Mm-hmm. It's a myth that everybody wants free trade and they're not going to try and get an advantage. So we have to first deal with that myth if we're going to make an improvement. Now, as far as tariffs and the effectiveness of tariffs, you know, tariffs are, they're not like a Swiss Army knife. You can't use them in every situation and they're not effective in every situation, but they certainly have their use and can be effective. You know, as an example, past administrations like President Reagan, he used quotas, actually, in relation to Japanese auto vehicles, and that had some positive effects. My approach would be to use tariffs strategically and selectively rather than broadly. It would be to indicate to the business community that, look, this is what we're going to be doing over the next 5 years. What that would do is that would give businesses time to plan. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't have the dislocation of the supply chains, you also wouldn't create as much investor angst, but then you also need to make sure that if you do implement tariffs, that you're covering all the countries of the world, not just one, so you're not just playing whack-a-mole. Now, having said that, there actually is another approach that would be better than tariffs, and that's very simple, which is tie each company in the U.S., tie the corporate tax rate that they pay to their rate of job creation. Why is that an approach that I'm advocating? Because then what you do is then you're not getting into a trade war, and two, you're providing a real concrete incentive for companies to increase hiring in America, which is the goal of the tariffs that the president is implementing. So that would be a different approach, or if nothing else, I would at least do that in concert with the tariffs, but I would just take a little different approach.
Let me understand this. First of all, when we're buying goods from overseas, I guess the expectation is that they're manufacturing these goods at much lower prices. So basically, while we're paying more and giving them more money, hence the deficit, we're importing lower prices, which helps the consumer. So it's kind of complicated. And I am not an economist by any means, but I mean, I have read that. So if, in fact, the U.S. worker is more expensive, so it's, you know, it's cheaper to go abroad, it's too expensive to manufacture at home, is this idea about giving a tax rate benefits to the employers a way of reducing the cost of higher wage workers?
It's a way of making our companies and producing in the U.S. more competitive. So there is a labor cost differential. Now, part of what is left out as it relates to the lower cost of goods to consumers is that there's also a kind of an unnoticed cost, which is that, you know, when you have the Verrazano Bridge in New York buying steel from China, and I forget if it's the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco from China, what that does is you get cheaper steel, but then you also have less employment in the U.S. So it's not a simple, hey, you know what, we're getting lower priced goods, so that's good for American consumers. That puts downward pressure on wage growth in the U.S. So as you pointed out, it's not a black and white. It does get complicated, but we need to start accounting for some of those costs of the cheaper goods from overseas, because if I'm getting paid a lower wage or I just don't have a job, those quote-unquote cheap goods are actually very expensive to me.
Yeah, if you don't have money, everything is expensive. You know, General Motors just announced they're laying off 14,000 workers. And in one of your articles, you wrote that they still, of course, got the benefit of the big tax cut last year. And I think what you're saying is that your idea would be to say, hey, you don't really get a tax cut if you're now going to turn around and lay off 14,000 workers. It kind of goes against the sense that the tax cut is supposed to give companies more money and give them an opportunity to take that extra money, invest it in the economy to create more jobs. But you have a company like GM, which is actually doing the opposite. Where does that fit into the spectrum?
Well, it fits into the spectrum of missed opportunity. And, you know, I come from a background of ROI, or return on investment. So that's the framework by which I evaluate things. And so, again, while something needed to be done to our tax code, it was a missed opportunity, because what they could have very simply said was, okay, if the return that we want is more American jobs, then simply make the tax cuts conditional for each company on actually increasing hiring. Instead, what they did was they had a universal and unconditional tax cut. So companies creating jobs would get the cuts, companies firing Americans would get the cuts. And again, coming from a background of return on investment, that was just not the best approach. And they simply could have said, look, companies, you increase hiring, you're going to lower your tax rate. If you don't, it's just going to stay the same. It's really just that simple.
You know, but here's the problem I have with that. I don't understand how a company can just create jobs. I mean, the jobs are there based upon the amount of business that's done and the cost of doing business and all that. You just can't like wave a magic wand and say, because I'm getting $3 billion back from the government in taxes or something like that, that I can start to create jobs. I don't see how the two come together.
Well, based on that premise, then we should have never done the tax cuts. Because if what you said is true, but I don't necessarily disagree with it, then cutting the tax rate would have had no impact on job creation, so there was no point to do it.
I guess that's a good point.
Yeah, you make an interesting point. So what I'm saying is I'm trying to bridge the gap between those who believe that if you cut taxes, that will generate more jobs, and those who are skeptical and believe that companies don't create jobs just because they've got a lower tax rate, and there's real validity to that. I'm trying to bridge that by using a concept from my background in finance called an earnout, which says, okay, you believe if you do something, cut taxes, that's going to create more jobs. I'm skeptical, so let's do this. If you actually create more jobs, we'll cut your tax rate. And if you don't, then we won't. And that's how you bridge the gap between those two different philosophical views.
Okay. Well, you know, unemployment, the June numbers were announced, and unemployment shot up to 224,000 new jobs, is what I'm saying, is new jobs were created, which is a terrific number. So when you look at the amount of jobs that are being created in 2019, 2018, it does seem like overall, I don't know if it's due to the tax cut, but overall, the economy is doing extremely well. How would you look at that 224,000 in some historic light?
Sure. Well, I think what's important to keep in mind is that we're still adding a robust number of jobs. I mean, 170,000 a month, especially at this late point in the cycle, that's a good number. That's an ample number for the economy. And we'll keep the economy going.
That 170 is the average for 2019, right?
Yes. Thank you for clarifying. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So for the first 6 months of 2019, we've been adding about 170,000 jobs a month. And so that's good. Now,
right.
Some people say there's a concern because we were at 223, but what you have to look at is that 223 was artificial. That was due to fiscal stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, most people didn't expect that to be maintained. What we expected was we'd go back basically to the future or to 2017 and go back to where the job growth was prior to the fiscal stimulus. So the economy is doing what it should be doing right now, is going back to a more sustainable level.
Yeah. Okay. So that's good news. You know, let's look at some of the other news. Inflation is very tame. Now, I started in the investment world in the early 80s. And actually, it came in and, you know, 2.5 year CDs were at 16%, and
yep,
30-year treasuries were 13%, and inflation was 10, 12, 14%. And now this idea, you know, inflation is at 2%, and, you know, that the Fed's actually worried about deflation just seems still such an oddball thing to me, because all we ever wished for was low inflation. So we have that. We have low inflation. Interest rates have remained extremely low. The 10-year treasury is about 2.1% now. I remember there was a time when we never thought it would get to 5% or to 7%. And now it's been hovering around this 2% level for so many years. We have good job growth. We have good economic numbers. And yet, here's what my question, you know, I work with a lot of individuals and investing money, and the stock market's been rising. And nobody really believes it. Nobody is happy about it. Everybody is waiting for the next crash or next shoe to drop and so on. I don't know any bull market that's ever died on such pessimism. What do you think about where we stand right now?
Well, it sure is an interesting environment. So the one thing I would like to point out is that, you know, we've got the job growth. We've got decent wage growth. It's come down a little bit, but, you know, that was to be expected. Yes, manufacturing is slowing somewhat. Yes, global growth is slowing somewhat. There is trade policy uncertainty. No, but we still have an expanding economy. And so it seems like the choices are always, oh, we're going into a significant equity market decline tomorrow, or the stock market is going to continue going up for forever. And the reality is that if you look at the economics of the situation, the stock market, as long as things keep going the way they are, should have decent earnings growth. Now, should we be setting records? What I can say is that I'm not comfortable with an environment where we're setting stock market records with a market that is so heavily dependent on a Fed rate cut.
Yeah.
That's actually the biggest concern I have, is that this market is just, it's got a high degree of dependence on the Fed rate cut. Mm-hmm. And that does not give me a lot of confidence in the market, because theoretically, if the equity markets are that strong, you shouldn't need a Fed rate cut.
Yeah. Well, you know, the market so far is up about 18% this year, plus or minus, depending upon the day, of course. I had a kind of a bad May and a terrific June and now July. So, you know, I guess dividends are still rising with the underlying stocks. Even international stocks, with all the bad news that seems to be going on about them, those international stocks have done pretty well. So, I mean, do you expect some kind of disaster right around the corner?
No, certainly I don't expect a disaster right around the corner. What I do expect is that we're going to have continuing volatility, because the markets are going to be buffeted by continuing trade policy uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do get a Fed rate cut in July, you know, that the markets will love that. Although, interestingly, that would indicate that the Fed sees some headwinds in the economy.
Right.
So I'm not quite able to reconcile those two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But even after, if they do get that Fed rate cut, you know, they're still going to be faced with the reality of earnings and what those look like. And the reality that, while still okay, the economy is slowing, both domestically and globally. And what are the implications of that for earnings?
Well, Chris, we're out of time. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. Chris Mackey is founder of Solutionomics, which you can Google and find his great site there. And you can follow him as well on Reading the Hill and other publications. To hear this and any interview again, or if you have a question about what we've just discussed, visit our website, which is stevepomerantz.com, as you know, and join our conversation. Ask us any questions that you may have. We love to answer your questions. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update where you'll get in your inbox every single week just a one-pager saying what we've discussed, and you can listen to the entire show. You can listen to one segment or just read the segment or read the full transcript. It's up to you depending upon your interest and time. Don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. Chris, once again, thank you so much.
Certainly been my pleasure. Look forward to doing it again.